Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Environment and Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today's date is Tuesday, March 27th, and before us we have the minutes for March 22nd. Representative Clark Johnson, would you move the minutes for us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I move the minutes for March 22.
Any additions or corrections on the minutes, members? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the minutes are approved. Okay, first up today we have House File 3153. Representative Lumen is here, and I will move that House File 3153 be re-referred and sent to GovOps.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
And I want to thank you and the committee for hearing this bill. Kind of an overview of this bill. What it does is it modifies the recycling grant program. Currently, only counties can apply for the grants, and we want to broaden that to some of the other users or potential opportunities for recycling situations. And I'll acquiesce to my testifier.
Good morning. Would you identify yourself for the record and proceed?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I'm Paul Nelson. I'm the Environmental Services Program Manager for Scott County. And as Representative Lunan said, what we're looking for is some flexibility in the language right now. The language that's in law limits match for the state grants to be solely provided by counties. So that means that as a county, only the county can provide that dollar amount to match. I have lots of local partners in terms of our tribal community in Scott County, private businesses, cities, and so forth, that also could be providing this match. Reaching the new 75% recycling goal is going to be quite a challenge, and I need to bring in more partners and more resources, and this is a way that we think we can do that, and so we're asking your flexibility. Just broaden who can provide the match. That's all I have. I'll stand for questions.
Representative Clark Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your testimony. I'm curious, have you encountered any private entities that are interested in helping with the match?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. Yes, we have some businesses that are looking forward to recycling themselves and putting in some of the infrastructure, bins or enclosures. We also have Demcon Landfill, who has started an education program. That wouldn't be eligible now because it's now an existing program, but those are the types of things that we can do.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lunan, would this bill allow for private matches along with other public entities?
That is correct. One of the exciting things we have going on, I represent the River South area, which is the Shakopee area. We've got an entity called Coda Energy, and what they do is they take basically storm debris from the Hennepin County area, the Scott County area, and turn it into the equivalent to a biomass fuel. You know, if there's we get down the road here where we can do carbon capture on some of this, you aren't going to have a carbon neutral energy source. You're going to have a carbon negative energy source, because those trees when they're growing take carbon out of the atmosphere. When they die and decay, they release the methane. Well, that down the road, I sense the future is going to have a carbon capture. So we've got private entities that are very, very interested in joining in on this. They would just put like a little nudge.
Representative Johnson, anything else? Okay. Representative Wagenius.
Scott County testifier, I think one of the problems we're running into with not having enough money is we're using the solid waste money now to pay for other people's fees at the PCA. So the money that should be allocated to counties is not going to counties. And that's one of the reasons you're having just the overall shortage of money. And one of the things that we should be resolving on your behalf is making sure that people, say, who want a water permit fee, pay their own fees instead of having solid waste pay it. So that's one of the issues that is, I'm a metropolitan county person, and one of the issues that we have.
Mr. Nelson, I'm curious, on your 75% recycling goal, where does that come from?
That is statutory.
Okay.
In 2014.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Yeah, Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the Representative Lunan. I'm just wondering about if you're handing out grants to private entities, a company, recycling company, or whatever, should we be requiring some kind of financial statement, some kind of guarantee of their financial viability, let's say? I'm looking for like a history of what they've accomplished or what they proposed to before we start handing out state funds to them.
Representative Lunan.
Thank you for the question, Representative. And actually, this is a matching situation, so there is some of that incorporated. I'm assuming my testifier can speak to that better than I can, but earlier DEMCON was mentioned. And they have not waited. They've taken the initiative to go through a rigorous recycling program and even gone so far as to create an educational facility, which I invite all of you. I'd be happy to take you down there and show you what they have set up on the single sort recycling that they do down there. It's a fascinating blend of physics and environmental science.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lunan. I think I can support this, but I do have an amendment for you at your next committee stop, I believe.
Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Representative. We can certainly talk.
Any other questions? Next, I'd like to have Dave Benke come down from MPCA. We just keep recycling the same testifiers. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Benke. I'm the Director of the Resource Management Assistance Division at the PCA. We've taken a look at this language, and I think it is a new angle on some of the recycling grants that come out of the PCA. This one in particular is dedicated to the 7-county metro area. The Metro Landfill Abatement Account generates the fee that's used for this grant funding, and only the 7-county metro area can be eligible for it. So leveraging additional partners to reach that 75% goal, I think, is a good idea. And I think with a couple of changes that we've offered that are incorporated in here, and we thank the author for that, I think we've got something that we can look at and see how this works going down the road.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Benke, members? Okay, very good. Then I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 3153 to go to GovOps. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. You're on your way. You guys get your beards taken care of here now. Isn't hurt. Oh, look who's back. Well, by golly, look at that.
Wow. This is the sequel. This is the sequel, Representative.
Good morning. Welcome. I'm going to move to re-refer House File 3210 to GovOps Committee. So, before us today to go through House File 3210 is Representative Lunan.
And again, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee members, for hearing this bill as well. House File 3210 deals with stormwater management and tries to create equity between the 7-county area and the outstate. What this bill does is this is an important bill to the outer ring of the ever-growing outer ring of the metropolitan area, where you have unincorporated areas. Right now, the counties are not allowed to actively be involved out in the unincorporated areas, whereas in outstate, obviously, they have a higher incidence of that. They are, and we're finding some problems. And again, I'm going to turn it over to my testifier to just walk through this.
Good morning again, Mr. Hansen. How are you? Or Nelson, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What was interesting to me when I looked at this is thinking about why were metro counties excluded in the first place. And as I look back at that and think about it, stormwater management, we're trying to keep water from accumulating on roads, move it safely through communities, and now we're also adding water quality functions to that. That does make more sense in the urban environment and in cities where we have more density, more people living, more things in harm's way. And so you know, makes some sense that originally counties weren't kind of in that role in the metropolitan area, because we also had the Metropolitan Surface Water Management Act that mandated watershed authorities throughout the metropolitan area. Most of those watershed authorities originally were either watershed districts or joint powers watershed management organizations that were joint powers between municipalities. Municipalities had that authority for stormwater utilities. Now, back in 2000 or so, some of those municipal-based joint powers organizations were declared non-implementing by the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and what arose out of the ashes of that was county-based watershed management organizations. If we're a joint powers watershed management organization, our powers go back to the original powers of those entities in the joint powers. Counties don't have this authority for stormwater utility, even though now in Scott WMO, Scott Watershed Management Organization, Carver Watershed Management Organization, and the Vermilion River Joint Powers Watershed Organization, which covers now probably a third of the metro area, counties are the ones with the watershed authority. It hasn't been an issue for me till more recently. We've been slowly accumulating the stormwater facilities and so forth, but I look to the future, and it's going to be an issue for us in terms of maintaining facilities that we are enabling, either through our watershed management role or through our permitting role when we have to do permits under the Clean Water Act that requires to put in some sort of stormwater facilities. So basically, we're asking for some of the same authorities that other watershed stormwater responsible types of entities have. With that, I'll stand for questions.
Questions, members? Okay, very good. All right, so with that, any final comments on your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This bill, the strength of this bill is the fact that it is proactive in nature and not reactive in nature. The testifier said, we're waiting until there's a problem. We know what problems would be ahead of us unless we act, and we're just asking for the authority to do that.
Thank you. With that, I'll renew my motion to refer House File 3210 to GovOffice. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Thank you.
Prevails. Thank you, Representative Lumen. And Mr. Nelson. Next up, we have House File 2858. It's the Chair's intention to lay this bill over. House File 2858 is chief authored by Representative Swedzinski. For your bill.
Thank you, Chair Fabian. Thank you, members. House File 2858 is a pretty straightforward bill. Under current law, it is allowable to use handheld light and shotgun to hunt coyote and fox at night, other predators. In this bill, I would just bring a little bit of common sense. Obviously, shooting a two-handed gun using one hand, using a handheld light, this simply allows you to use other light methods other than something that's handheld, something that may be potentially attached to the firearm itself. And then also, it just brings a little bit of common sense to the hunting of those predators that would allow you to use the same gun you use during the day. Which would be potentially a rifle or whatever gun that best fit your needs. Under current law, this is allowable. You could only use shotgun, and this would allow it to use any particular firearm to do this work. So I've got a testifier here that would like to speak on behalf of this bill as well.
Good morning. Good morning. Would you identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, my name is Ty Brower. I'm from Marshall, Minnesota. I am in support of this bill. The investment that we are doing throughout the state, and especially locally out southern, southwestern Minnesota, towards habitat restoration, we do a lot, and it's tough to see when we're walking through a field, pheasant hunting or turkey hunting, you see a pile of feathers from some predators. I do actively predator hunt. And with this bill, with the artificial light use and the rifle, it'll help us verify our target a lot better at night. You know, whether you use a light or not at night, the bullet's still going to travel as far as it will. But with the use of light, we can verify our target a lot better. And, you know, it's also legal in surrounding states. So I think if we were to get on board, it would assist us at night and during the day as well. So.
Mr. Brower, curious, in your testimony you referred to, you do a lot of work. Can you tell me who, what kind of work you do? Do you work for some?
Yep. So I'm actually the chapter president of the local National Wild Turkey Federation chapter in Marshall, and do a lot of fundraising for, you know, land habitat enhancement, land purchases. We just planted over 8,000 trees on the James Meagher WMA that was donated to the DNR last year. We're actually in the process right now of purchasing 123 acres just north of Russell, Minnesota, right on the river bottom. Great habitat for pheasants, turkey, deer, also coyotes and fox as well. You know, and our habitat enhancement is for all creatures, but, you know, the predators, they don't have much for predatory themselves as well. So just to kind of help keep them in check, as well as all the other critters. So
how's your success in turkey hunting in the spring?
Well, last spring I archery hunted and I scared one because I tried the spot and stock method. You know, I got to do it as hard as possible, but I'm self-taught and I've gotten one so far. So
good for you.
Thank you.
If there was some guy from northwest Minnesota that wanted to go turkey hunting sometime, that could be arranged.
Yes. Come on down. I'll take you out.
All right. I'm just kidding. You know that. All right. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Szczesinski. I just went through gun safety training with my son, and primary component was know your target, but also know what's behind your target. So I watched as he actually went through some scenarios with the instructor on should you shoot or shouldn't you shoot, based on what was behind the target. So with the rifle at night, how do you verify what's behind your target?
Mr. Brower,
Mr. Chair, currently you're at the mercy of the moonlight. So hunters hunting at night are only hunting, you know, 3 days before full moon, 3 days after. I've never hunted beyond that 6 days of stretch because it's just too dark. And, you know, morally it's not right. So with artificial light use, you'd be able to verify your target and also what is beyond. And I, too, am a firearm safety instructor. We start in Marshall next week, so that's one of the key components that we talk about.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, I hear all the time about one size doesn't fit all, and there's a lot of diversity in the topography of our state. And I know in the area where I turkey hunt, and there's a lot of CRP, the idea of rifle firing on the hills and the valleys, that scares me. I don't want that at night. And I know that I'm sure you're an ethical hunter and people are, but with a rifle, it's different than a shotgun. Those bullets can go a long ways, and you can't verify your target. You can't verify if there's a cow or a horse 100 yards behind, or if there's a kid. So I just can't support this. I think it, I understand, and I, you know, I appreciate people doing conservation work and habitat work, but switching to the rifle, I really have concerns about at night.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, it is legal to use rifle at night right now. It is not legal to use artificial light with the rifle. It is legal to use shotgun at night as well, and you can use artificial light with the shotgun. So to hunt with a rifle right now, there's no artificial light. So like I mentioned, to verify your target, it's at the full moon. Now, if we can use artificial light, we have a better source of light to verify that target at night throughout the season of January 1st through March 31st.
Mr. Brower, walk me through what you use for light. I mean, I know what I have. Can you tell me what you use and how many candle power and how far it actually shines and you can identify your target?
Yep. So I currently don't have a light right now just because it's not legal, but doing research for this, there's a lot of these, you know, high-power LED lights that attach to the rifle, and they claim that they can, you can see out to 800 yards through the scope, and you can verify your target out to 300 yards. Now, when predator hunting, it's very rarely that you're hunting out that far. Now, most of your targets are within that 100, 200 yards, so that's well within their claim that, you know, you can easily verify a target at 300 yards.
Thank you. Representative Becker Finch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I noticed that the DNR is on deck, so I think my concern had to do with how the DNR is going to be able to enforce poaching when you've got people shining, and now we've got people, you know, potentially walking around with deer rifles and lights at night, and but maybe the DNR can speak to that, how this would affect their ability to enforce.
Any comments on that?
Yeah, well, with current law right now with shotgun, you still have to be within you have to be 70 yards away from either a house or the road. So when people are spotlighting, or if they spotlight, usually it's right off the road. So if the DNR is within the area and they see somebody on the road, whether it's legal or not, you know, if it were to be legal for predator hunting, if you're spotlighting off the road, it's still illegal. Mm-hmm. You have to be off the road, away from a vehicle, and away from a house to do this.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And respectfully, I don't think that I think poachers. We've had people take deer on our property, out of season, mm-hmm. out of, you know, daylight, and it doesn't always happen right off the road. I think we're making a big assumption about people who are poaching by assuming they're always doing it just off the side of the road. Yeah. Yeah. So I would still love to hear from the DNR mm-hmm. about. How this would affect their ability to do their jobs.
Colonel Smith. Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, Colonel Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chair, members, we'd like to, first I'd like to thank Representative Swedinski for bringing this forward. There is something that does need to be fixed here, and that is under line 1.9, when it talks about using a handheld artificial light. That has been a kind of a point of concern for folks. I mean, you can put a headlight on. Is that handheld? No, it's on your head. And so, obviously, we'd like to work with the author to find some type of language that works for that handheld portion. But we do have some of the same concerns that Representative Hansen brought forward. One of the primary tenets of firearm safety is know your target and beyond. And when this language was originally put, looked at several years ago, we did settle on shotgun because obviously a shotgun pattern can't travel as far as a rifle. They can travel much farther than what the light will illuminate. And so we do have that concern about getting into rifle with using an artificial light. Traditionally, coyote hunters, when we talk about moonlight, coyote hunters would be in a stationary position. And a fresh snow and a full moon, they can see very well. I think many people have been out after a fresh snow and a full moon. It's almost like daylight. And they're in a stationary position. They call, and then the predator comes in, and they have an idea what the background is and everything. And when we start moving to being on foot using an artificial light, even if you're on your own property, you're moving from one area to another. You're not really sure, like when you are stationary, what is beyond your target. And yes, there are lights, and there are some very bright lights, but those lights still will not shine farther than what a rifle can go. So because of that, we have concerns about expanding this past the use of shotguns.
Representative Swedinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a separate issue, but I just got a question for the DNR officer. You know, I know that the DNR uses thermal at night. To kind of just check and to enforce, you know, from a verification standpoint, do you think thermal would allow for verification of target better than a flashlight?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the way we use thermal is a little different, I think, than the way hunters would use it. We're looking for people normally, and we're not shooting them, hopefully. And so we do have concerns with thermal and night vision. Also, it's about, you know, identifying your target, making sure what it is. And so we do have some issue with the use of thermal and night vision and expanding that. I mean, it is allowed in some other states. Just because it's allowed in other states, I guess it doesn't necessarily need to be allowed here in Minnesota. But we do get a lot of complaints from people where that our property owners at night, when they see spotlights running around, it makes some people uneasy that are landowners. And so, you know, expanding, you know, what we have now seems to work. And I just hate to see us have any unfortunate incidents with somebody overshooting their spotlight with a rifle.
Colonel Smith, when you use your thermals, how far away can you identify a human being?
Mr. Chair, I have not used the new technology lately, so I'm not quite sure how far they can see with those thermals. I'm stuck in the office.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just thinking back to the days when I was predator hunting, we'd always sit up on the logging piles up north, and we were always shooting down, so it was never a concern about where that bullet was going. With the would it give comfort to the department if the use of rifles were restricted to an elevated position so you're shooting down and the bullets aren't carrying into the neighborhoods?
Colonel Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that would help, but again, that's something that is hard to enforce. I can see getting called into representatives' offices about what is an elevated position and what is not an elevated position. So, but I agree with
you. No, Sundin.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. 8 foot, 10 foot, whatever.
Yeah.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel Smith, you talked about it's legal in other states. Talk about what kind of positive or negative ramifications have happened from our neighboring states with this type of legislation.
Colonel Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eklund, I just hear anecdotally from other states that they have had some increases in some deer poaching with the advent of the use of thermal imaging, night vision, and other things. Nothing formal. But just more anecdotal.
Okay. Anything else? Closing comments on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Good questions. We'd appreciate your consideration to include this. I will definitely like to work with DNR staff in formulating this bill to better get their approval, but also I think this is a bit on the common sense side, being that this also already exists and already happens without the existence of a light. I think we are adding to it and making it safer. Thank you.
Well, Representative Swazinski, I appreciate you, pardon the pun, members, but shining the light on predators. This is something that we need to really start tackling across the state of Minnesota with regards to these egg-eating and chick-eating machines out there, skunks and raccoons, in this case, coyotes and fox. If we want more ducks and if we want more pheasants, we're going to have to come to the realization that we have far too many of these other predators. So with that, the bill's laid over. Thank you. All right, next we have House File 3120. House File 3120 is one of my bills, and I will move to re-refer to the General Register. And with that, I'd like to move the author's DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like. So make sure, members, that you're working off the DE2. All those in favor of the DE2, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. And those opposed, the amendment is adopted. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Quillis. Identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I am the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I appreciate the time to make some comments on House File 3120, the DE2 amendment. Mr. Chairman, Sections 1 and 2 of this bill stem from conversations that we had with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. If you'll look on Section 2 on page 2.28, as we've had the wetland mitigation discussions over the last couple of years, it was noted that there are a number of caps dealing with wetland value replacement plans. And if you'll look on the bill on 2.24 and 2.25, where it says not to exceed 500. If you look on 2.26 and 2.27, not to exceed 1,000. And also over on 3.31 and 3.32, not to exceed 1,000. So we had noticed that there was not a cap on the withdrawal fee for credits. So our first thought was to put it seemed like the maximum cap was $1,000. And that was what was in the original bill. And then in subsequent conversations with the Board of Soil and Water and Soil Resources, you could see the language that's on 2.29 that says that the board must establish fees based on the cost to the agencies. So we didn't put a cap there. We just said that whatever the cost to the agencies was what that would be there. During those conversations, we also had, it came up about how some of the billing that the board does for their organizational units, you could see that on 2.12 to 2.16. And then again, some of the withdrawals for the water and soil conservation stewardship accounts and the mitigation easement stewardship accounts and how that money moves through there for legal compliance costs, structural preservation, and other costs dealing with database and web upgrades and repairs. So those are that's section one and two of the bill. Some of those are the caps that we started those conversations with, but then subsequently the Board of Water and Soil Resources found some other issues that they would like to see addressed, and I think they are here to answer questions on that, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
Section 3 deals with National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, or NPDES, permits and exemptions from those permits. If you'll look on 3.23 to 3.26, that is not verbatim, but very close to federal exemption language dealing with transfers of water. And so there is no, as you'll notice, it doesn't deal with polluted water or touched by industrial, municipal, or commercial, and does not require an NPDES. And it's an exemption. And there are 503 permits over the last 5 years that we looked at. And I'll give you a couple examples of folks that obtained this exemption from the NPDES permit and what those actions are. Those actions dealt with channel excavation, channel cleanouts, public water dams, drainage, temporary drawdowns, erosion or flood prevention, water level control structures, and people that apply for those. The entities range from the Brainerd Public Utilities, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources Wildlife Division, U.S. Forest Service, the City of St. Cloud, Fargo-Moorhead Water Diversion, the City of Champlin, University of Minnesota Duluth, Houston County Highway Department. Mr. Chairman, it's an exemption where we're moving water from one body to another through either a pump station, a canal, an aqueduct, a tunnel, a pipe, where there's no pollutants being discharged. We're just moving water. And as you can see, we thought we had those exemptions in state law. We had copied all of the EPA exemptions but one, and this was the one, is the water transfer rule. So we literally picked up the federal exemption and put it into state law. Section 4 is external peer review of water quality standards. We've had a lot of debate over the last couple of years over new water quality standards in this state and peer review of them and who should do them. Should the state agency do them? Should it be a third party that looks at them? Commissioner Stein addressed this in what's known as the July 14th directive to his employees on dealing with new and revised numeric water quality standards. And originally in the bill, when we took the what I'll call the Stein memo and put it into the bill, we forgot to include numeric and was pointed out to us by the Pollution Control Agency. So it was a good catch on their part, and that's why part of the DE goes through and puts the numeric provisions in there. Also wanted to point out that last night in the Legislative Water Commission, this was, I think there's four Senator Clark was there, Representative Fisher, and Representative Torkelson. I think this was provision number two that has been recommended by the Legislative Water Commission, and was discussed last night in the Water Commission by Mr. Stark. Subdivision 5, Mr. Chairman, is, you've seen before, that is House File 2802 that is on the General Register, was authored by Representative Lewick, dealing with 16-year permits for wastewater treatment plants. The difference here is on 5.17. It also includes industrial and along with municipal. Same with Section 6, Mr. Chairman, is Representative Bliss's House File 2940 that was on the General Register that we had a discussion, I think it was on Thursday of last week, dealing with legislative approval of fees for the water fees at the Pollution Control Agency. And then finally, again, Mr. Chairman, in Section 7, in our discussions with the Board of Water and Soil Resources, we talked about a in-lieu fee program and starting to go through and seek approval on the federal level for one of those, dealing specifically with the Red River Basin and the greater than 80% counties. So northern Minnesota and then down kind of a little bit along the western border, for them to start a planning framework. And this would be very similar to what they're doing right now on the St. Croix River. And so they would. This would allow them to start that process. And if they did obtain federal approval, they would report back to you and other committees with jurisdiction over environment and natural resources. With that, Mr. Chairman, I stand for any questions.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Quillis. I'm trying to keep track of, you know, what was last year. So Chamber Bill 1.0 last year and this is Chamber Bill 2.0, so what's different? I mean, I know there were things that moved last year but then didn't happen. And is this just another bite at the apple on some of this, or are these new Chamber proposals?
Mr. Corliss.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, this, I'm trying to think of what didn't make it last year through discussions with the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Natural Resources. Most of these have been conversations, things that have happened over the interim with the state agencies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Quillis. A couple of specific questions on 3.23, conveying or connecting waters of the state. So would that exemption apply if you had a continental divide and you were mixing waters from different watersheds, water basins? So we have three continental divides here. If there was a, let's say, a ditching project that's moving water, that would be exempted from the NPDES permit.
Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I have noticed that Ms. Lothammer is behind me on the testimony, and if I could, I'd like to phone her as a friend to answer that, because I don't want to, I think so, but she would be better off answering that than me, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Lothammer, please. And then Angie Becker-Cadell could be on deck as well. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Lothammer. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Water at the Pollution Control Agency. And I do have testimony kind of for the bill as a whole, but sure, specific to the question about lines 3.23 of the Delete Everything Amendment. The proposed change in this bill, actually, as Mr. Quillis had testified, really aligns Minnesota law with a federal regulation that excludes water transfers from federal National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permitting requirements. Many of these activities do have permitting through the Department of Natural Resources. As Mr. Quillis had noted, some of the activities that fall into this kind of category are permitted through the Department of Natural Resources through their work in public waters permits and other permits that they have. There was actually a recent Minnesota court decision that required NPDES permits for water transfers because Minnesota had not specifically adopted that federal exemption that exists on the federal level. I should note that that federal exemption was challenged in federal court, and the court upheld that federal regulation exemption last year. So that has been addressed on the federal level through the court system. In Minnesota, again, because we didn't have that specific exemption, MPDES permits were identified as being required by the Minnesota courts. This bill then would address the fact that that federal exemption is missing from Minnesota statutes and rules. The Pollution Control Agency actually has not historically issued NPDES permits for water transfers like this, so this would not change existing practice. Again, many of these types of activities are covered by DNR permits. The DNR, through their regulations, is already prohibited from issuing a permit that would cause water quality or water pollution issues, and the PCA often provides technical expertise and review when water quality concerns are raised by the DNR or by third parties for those permitted activities that the DNR is considering. So this proposed bill language would facilitate lake and stream management to address water quantity issues without allowing the introduction of pollutants, and with the existing relationship between the DNR and the PCA for evaluating any potential water quality concerns to make sure that those are avoided. And for that reason, that language is acceptable to the Pollution Control Agency.
Thank you. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on Mr. Quillis, on lines 4.27, and I think a couple weeks ago I raised concerns about purpose statements and the purpose of purpose statements, and the purpose of external review is to evaluate whether a technical support document, proposed standard, are based on sound scientific knowledge. Could you describe sound scientific knowledge, methods, and practices?
Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask Shannon to go through it again also, but I think literally we pulled off of, and it's going to take me time to find it, but I think we literally pulled off of it. I'm trying to find out if it's defined in the, what I'm going to call the Stein memo, which I think is in your packets, dated July 14th.
Mr. Chair, if I might respond. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Yes, so in the memo, the commissioner's order that the commissioner issued last summer, if you look on the second page, it's the 1, 2, 3, 4th dark bullet, and it's the third kind of open circle bullet underneath that. And that is the language that is also reflected in the proposed bill. And the proposed bill, as Mr. Quillis had indicated, is taking the commissioner's order and putting that into statute. The PCA is supportive of that proposal. This discussion about the type of review comes from the federal peer review manual that is issued by the Environmental Protection Agency. Through both the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, and then there's actually a memo from the Office of Management and Budget at the federal level, they do recommend that when there is significant new science or new methods, that be subject to independent peer review before that information is used in the establishment of a regulation, or in this case, a water quality standard. Now, the Pollution Control Agency always has relied on peer-reviewed science when we're developing and updating water quality standards. What the intent of the commissioner's order was, and it's stated in the order itself, is to really add additional clarity and transparency to that process by explicitly issuing a draft technical support document, putting that on public notice for comment, and then putting that through the peer review process. So that provides the opportunity for further public notice and participation in that peer review process by seeing that technical support document and providing feedback on the peer review. And then again, provides that greater transparency in how peer review is conducted in water quality standards.
Thank you. Representative Wardini, to this point, did you have?
Yeah, just to this point. Mr. Chair, this is Blackhammer. Your choice of the word sound rather than the word current, I mean, sound science of 1990 is great for 1990, but normally people would say current scientific knowledge.
Ms. Lotthammer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, so absolutely we use the most current available scientific knowledge. I think in this case, the intent of the word sound, as I remember from reading the EPA peer review manual, is that it is based on good practices from a scientific basis, that the data that went into the documents, the technical support document, are verifiable data, that there was good quality assurance and quality control practices, that the analytical methods that were used both for analyzing data and then also for statistical review and things like that are based on acceptable review practices. That's kind of the intent of that word sound in the context of the peer review. But absolutely when we're developing and updating water quality standards, we're relying on the most current available science.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I understand it took the language from the commissioner's order, but it appears to me the effect of all this is that we'll have perpetual review and never ever have a water quality standard ever set, because what it does is it interjects the interests into the decision making so that you get a draft, people complain, change the draft, people complain, change the draft, people complain, into infinity, and nothing ever will get done. A lot of economic development for the legal teams and compiling the experts, but then the environment suffers because we never get to a standard. Everything will always be in perpetual review. So I understand, you know, the agencies have been working on this. It will leave a legacy, maybe not the one you're looking for.
Representative Parkinson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure quite what to say to Representative Hansen. The gloom and doom is just unbelievable. The peer review process is an important process that has been utilized in permitting for a long time. But what's happened in the past is that's tended to happen at the very end of the process. Really, in my mind, the most important part of this work is that we will now utilize peer review earlier in the process so that the process can move more smoothly and more efficiently rather than waiting till the end and then mucking up the works at the very end of the process. So I applaud the commissioner. I applaud the author of this bill. I think it's a really good idea.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a question for Mr. Quillis. That section 3.23 to 3.26, you had mentioned in your testimony that it's close to but not verbatim of the federal law or standard. How is it different?
Mr. Quillis, and I think maybe Ms. Lotthammer addressed
that. Well, I was going to say, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to also ask Ms. Lotthammer, but I think the federal exemption literally says waters of the United States, and this would say waters of the state.
Okay. Ms. Lotthammer.
Mr. Chair, I don't have the federal exemption in front of me, so I just need to compare the two.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Well, thanks. I mean, if there's nothing substantive in terms of the difference, then that's good to know, but sometimes these small one word or two words can make a difference, so it would be helpful to know.
Thank you. Representative Bickerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering, I think this is a question from Ms. Lotthammer. Back to the peer review section, what would the cost...
What line are you on? Representative Bickerfin.
What would the... associated costs be with having these additional public comment periods? Obviously, there would be staff and time required to do that. Could you speak a little bit to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beckerfin, we have already started to establish as a best practice that we put out the draft technical support document as a draft for public comment. So there wouldn't be any additional costs associated with that compared to our best practice. We haven't quantified exactly what the costs would be for the peer review piece because it's really variable depending on the scope of the particular rulemaking. I think with a very small rulemaking that doesn't have a large technical support document, it would be potentially as simple as sending out then that draft to some technical experts for their review. And I think the cost would be quite nominal. It would be based on just how many hours they need to spend. If we were to go forward with more of a panel, and in particular if it was a public panel like we did voluntarily for the wild rice rulemaking, I think the cost for that, we worked with a third party that actually took care of all of the arrangements, and there were five reviewers that actually traveled to Minnesota for that. I think the total cost was about $120,000. But quite frankly, personally, having been involved in that, I think that those resources were very well spent, both to enhance the transparency of the process, and we actually got some very significant technical information and feedback from that process that really did improve the final product that then went forward through the rulemaking process.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to that, obviously, transparency is good. The public having the opportunity to comment is good. Just wondering how I'm looking at line 4.22, that all the comments made would be available to the external peer reviewers. So if the peer reviewers are looking at the science that's being used, how do you imagine the public, because I've read through what public comments can sometimes look like, and I'm just trying to figure out how you think that's going to, if you could speak to how that's going to get us to a better result.
Ms. Lothammer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Becker-Finn, so the way that this worked out, and we would model this process, this is actually modeled after both what's in the EPA's peer review handbook and then the process that we followed for the peer review of the preliminary information around wild rice, is that, but for peer review, and this is laid out in the EPA's handbook that is also referenced in the legislation, the steps are to identify the independent experts that haven't been involved in the development of the science to conduct the review, and then to develop what's called a charge, which is basically a series of questions to pose to those peer reviewers. So they have specific questions that they're responding to, and the questions really speak to the underlying scientific basis that's part of the technical support document. So in the example of the wild rice rulemaking, we had about a three-page, four-page document that was sent to the peer reviewers, the independent reviewers, that asked questions like, you know, do you have any questions or concerns about the way that the laboratory experiments were conducted, or the agency is preliminarily drawing some of these conclusions or putting this information together, do you think that that's a reasonable approach based on the science? Then we also had public comments that were provided about the charge and about the technical document, and we also included that then in the packet that went to the peer reviewers. Their charge was still focused on those questions, but we provided that additional information if they wanted to look at that, so that they had that at their disposal as well from a transparency standpoint and also from evaluating the comments that we did receive. So they would have those specific questions that they would be responding to. That additional information would provide additional context and transparency.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's interesting that you're talking so much about the wild rice rulemaking and the process that you use. You know, it all sounds great, and I appreciate the science-based results that we came to. But then, as you know, the majority of the legislators here have rejected that, the result of all that work and transparency and public comment and science. And so my concern is that if we're going to pass this because we think we're going to get good results, then we as a legislature and members need to, if we're going to, you know, go all in on this process, then we need to respect the outcome of that peer review and that science and that transparency and that public comment. So, again, while I appreciate the process that went into that, unfortunately, it didn't get us to a good outcome in the end. And so that's my big concern. I understand it's best practice, that's great, but if we aren't valuing following the best practice, then I don't see what the point is of forcing this process for everything.
So, Representative Beckerfin, the ALJ was involved in this as well, right? I mean, that was where the rejection of the rule came from.
Mr. Chair, so are you happy with the results?
That's not the point. I'm just clarifying the record right now, okay?
Okay.
Because you said the legislature did that.
Mr. Chair, I see Ms. Representative Lewick nodding his head. I mean, I think we all know where folks stand on that.
Sure. Okay.
So, thank you.
Representative Perkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lothamer, I see this letter is dated, or the memorandum is dated July 14th, 2017. Since the commissioner issued this memorandum, has the agency been abiding by this memorandum in its work?
Ms. Lothamer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, yes, we have. We have not public noticed any new proposed rule or numeric water quality standards. But we are in the process of working on our numeric water quality standards, and we're putting together the details about the next proposed standard that is put on public notice, or where we're ready to start moving forward to make sure that we incorporate the peer review directive from the commissioner into that.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Ms. Lothamer. And the language that's in the bill, do you feel it accurately reflects the memorandum?
Commissioner Lothamer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, yes, I do.
Well, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So really all we're doing here is putting into statute what the commissioner has already put into force via the memorandum. Thank you.
Commissioner Lothamer.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, that is the case. And I would like to note that we recognize that, you know, doing scientific peer review won't necessarily take away the controversy or concerns or questions around water quality standards development, but that's why there is the Administrative Procedures Act as well. That includes the public notice and comment, the administrative hearings, the report of the administrative law judge. The intent here is to provide additional, or at least the intent of the commissioner's order, is to provide that additional transparency and that additional kind of assertion or clarity to Minnesotans that the science that's underlying this rulemaking process has been reviewed independently. Often there's many other things that go into a rulemaking that are subject to concerns and comments, and that will still remain, but the rest of the administrative process is designed to address that.
Thank you. Next, excuse me, Representative Guagenius. You're looking pretty anxious there, Representative Guagenius, like you were. Forget him.
For Mr. Quillis, there seems to be an assumption in this room, but it was never stated, that this is the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Quillis.
Representative Ogenius, it's Representative Fabian's bill, and I'm speaking in support of House File 3120.
Representative Ogenius.
It is Representative Fabian's bill. Is it wholly supported by the Chamber of Commerce?
Mr. Quillis.
Representative Guagenius, Mr. Chairman, yes, along with the Pollution Control Agency and the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Commissioner Lothamer, you seem to have a comment there. I'll let you.
Sure. If I could.
Sure. Representative Guagenius.
So I want to look at Section 5 of the bill. And I am representing folks who drink Mississippi River water, but there are a lot more than my constituents that do that. There are a million Minnesotans that drink river water, specifically a million Minnesotans that drink river water from the upper Mississippi basin. And so they're from Minneapolis, St. Paul, lots of suburbs, and St. Cloud. So above the drinking water systems of intakes of Minneapolis and St. Paul in the suburbs, there are 203 wastewater treatment plants. How many industrial, because you've added industrial plants, wastewater treatment plants, are there in this upper Mississippi basin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guagenius, before I attempt to answer Representative Guagenius's question, I don't want to imply that the Pollution Control Agency and the Board of Water and Soil Resources support everything in this bill. I think that's where Ms. Lothammer was going to
smack
me on the side of the head and say, we don't support this whole thing. But, Mr. Chairman, Representative Arginius, I don't know. I could probably ask the Pollution Control Agency in that watershed north of the Twin Cities how many of those are industrial and how many of those are municipal. I can't answer that question, but I bet the agency could probably break that out for us.
Representative Arginius.
Well, the 203 that I mentioned are municipal. In addition to that, there are industrial. So if you don't know the number, then I'm assuming you also don't know how far upstream each of these are from the drinking water intakes for St. Cloud or Minneapolis or St. Paul. Do you know that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Arginius, I do not know the depth of every single NPDES permit for an industrial discharge and their distance from a municipality, no.
Representative Arginius.
I'm sorry, I don't think you got my question. I am looking at industrial dischargers. So the first question are, how many are there upstream from drinking water intakes? That's question one, and apparently you don't know the answer. So I'm assuming you also don't know the answer to how far upstream are each of these facilities upstream from our drinking water intakes. Is that true?
Mr. Close.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Arginius, yes, I am not familiar with every single industrial discharge NPDES permit in this state, so I can't comment on how many there are, but I can get that information. I'm sure the Pollution Control Agency has that. And what their exact distance is from drinking water facilities in the state, I can't comment on that. I wouldn't have that information.
If you don't know the number or how far they are, you don't know what additional pollutants we will get in our drinking water.
Mr. Chairman,
yep.
Representative Arginius.
Mr. Close.
There are a process that Ms. Lothammer touched on a little bit, the Administrative Procedures Act, that as these facilities, first of all, the key here, it's in both Representative Lewitt's bill and in this bill, to the extent allowable under federal law. So if the federal law doesn't allow it, we can't do it. And if we apply for a permit and somebody objects to it, there are a number of procedures for them to follow through the public comment period, a public hearing, a contested case to challenge that permit. And none of those go away, and that's established in law.
And that's in the bill online, the 5.16 members. Representative Wagenius.
Well, you were making the assumption there that the federal government is protecting our drinking water. I don't think there's a person in Minnesota right now who would make that assumption that the federal government is protecting our drinking water. So what I am looking at, and unfortunately, they're not. So that does not give me any comfort. So the question is, we need to know not only how many, that's the small issue, how far they are north of our drinking water intakes, that's a bigger issue, but even bigger is what are the pollutants that are being discharged by these industrial plants. And what this does is preclude any new regulation. So, for example, I know that the PCA has done some random testing of pharmaceuticals in our water bodies, including our drinking water bodies, and found that they are out there in higher numbers than people would have expected. So you are saying with this proposal that nobody should look at what pharmaceuticals are coming in to our drinking water and saying, well, let's not protect kids, and that's what I'm worried about, let's not protect kids from adults' pharmaceuticals. So I'm really disappointed to hear that the Chamber of Commerce is making this proposal without knowing any consequences of what this proposal will mean.
Thank you. Representative Ublin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for the chamber here. Going back to the Stein memo about peer review and everything else, and it's quoted as saying that the goal of peer review is to obtain independent review of the product from experts who have not contributed to its development. Mr. Corliss, does that actually preclude industry and the people that have developed a product from contributing their knowledge because they've done all the research and everything? Does that preclude them from entering into the peer review process?
Mr. Corliss.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ublin, I don't think so. I think what the intent is, if you're an environmental consultant and you've gone through to help develop those standards, you're an environmental engineering firm, you're an environmental consultant, you've gone through it, you would, in my opinion, then exclude yourself from any of that peer review. I don't think it would exclude any of the business input or environmental groups' input or public input, but I just think if you're an environmental consultant that's come in and helped establish some of these standards, that would exclude yourself from the process.
Okay, thank you.
No, that's fine. Okay, next up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess an ongoing concern I've had, I think we should have a good peer review process, but I have a little different idea of what peer review means. I think that science should be able to be replicated, and I guess my question would be, is that proven through the peer review process in the filler in your agency?
Mr. Chair and Representative Metza, so again, we're basing the peer review on the EPA and the Office of Management and Budget guidance, and that's really focused on, is there a sound technical basis? It doesn't necessarily mean has the studies been replicated exactly, but have they been done using sound management or sound scientific practices? Are the analytical methods accepted practice? Those kinds of things. And that is the definition that is included at the federal level as well.
Representative Metza.
And thank you, Ms. Chair. So does that mean if there were two conflicting scientific reports on the same information, I guess, what does the agency do at that point? If one group of science says this is the outcome with the same process and the, another has, or say the internal outcome is different, what happens then?
Ms. Lauthammer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Metza, so if what you're asking is if there's two kind of equally peer-reviewed, scientifically valid pathways or results, then it's the responsibility of the agency as the designated Clean Water Act implementer and with our requirements under the Federal Clean Water Act to adopt water quality standards to then make a determination as to which of those best reflects the requirements under the Clean Water Act of protecting the beneficial use, so the reason why we're adopting a standard in the first place, and then move that forward through the administrative process. And that's why that administrative process is so important as well, is because that provides that additional input to then weigh in on that beneficial use, the process followed, things like that. Because there are times when there is science that's in conflict, and it's credible science, but then decisions need to be made about what of that scientific body sort of is the best reflection of what it is that we're charged with accomplishing. And then there's public notice and comment and process around that.
Even in science, it's hard to come up with absolutes. Representative Metza. Okay, good. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, for Assistant Commissioner Lathammer, going back to the memo that the Commissioner wrote, when the memo was issued at that point in time, how much was it changing what the current practice in the agency was?
Commissioner Lathammer.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Fisher, so the memo really was solidifying a best practice that was emerging through the agency. Again, we've always relied on peer-reviewed science, but often the way that we've done that is through submitting journal articles for publication in peer-reviewed refereed journals. So those articles go through review before they're accepted for publication. We've also relied on EPA in their oversight authority over our water quality standards adoption, doing peer review before they then decide to approve or disapprove a proposed standard. So, but we've actually been developing this process now of developing a technical support document and making that available before moving into the formal rulemaking process. What this does is it solidifies that practice and requires that we public notice that, not just put it on our website, but actually do a public notice, and then also that we explicitly conduct that peer review at that time. Again, that does a couple of things. It reinforces the transparency. It makes sure that the peer review happens in with the opportunity for the public to follow it. And also it happens earlier in the process than, for example, if it's EPA peer review that happens before a water quality standards proposal is approved or disapproved. So it adds that transparency. It adds that kind of earlier feedback. It recognizes where we are moving towards as a best practice, but it really kind of puts that more solidly in place.
Representative Fisher.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. That helps. So, and just making sure I'm restating properly. So, as I'm hearing your explanation, this is the document that kind of finalizes the evolution of what the agency was going through in increasing transparency and making clear to people how we're doing this process across the land. Okay, thank you. That is very helpful.
Thank you.
And then I've got another question in another section. And I'm not too sure who to direct this one to. This goes to Section 105, the effluent limit part. And as I'm looking at this, this feels a little bit like the Lewis bill that we saw earlier. And I'll just express my concerns that I had before on that one is I have concerns about getting that 16-year for the municipalities, but I'm also very open to the point. I've been looking at some languages saying if we do something, require something that 16-year, is that we're helping pay and working with the MPCA to figure that out. So I do have concerns about that section of that one there.
And to your point, Representative Fisher, this is the LUIC. You were correct, but that's been stated here. But go ahead, testifiers.
Mr. Chair and members, I wonder if it would make sense for me to finish out the rest of the testimony from the perspective of the agency, since it will touch on that piece, if that...
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I do want to point out again, so the agency is, you know, is if we're ex- we accept we're, we support the language in Section 3 about the water transfers exemption. Again, we support the language in Section 4 about the external peer review. And then moving on to Section 5, which is the effluent limit compliance, I do want to note that, as was just discussed, this language is similar to language that was passed last year. And the Pollution Control Agency was neutral on that language last year. And we're neutral on this language with the one exception that we do oppose the inclusion of industrial permittees in this language. That language wasn't, or the previous language from last year did not include industrial permittees. The reason why the agency has concerns about industrial permittees is because under the Federal Clean Water Act, looking at affordability considerations and things like that, there are different tools that are used and guidance that's provided by the Environmental Protection Agency for looking at publicly owned treatment works, municipal permittees, compared to industrial permittees. And so while we feel very comfortable that we are able to implement this language consistent with the Clean Water Act for municipal permittees, we do have more concern with industrial permittees, and therefore that's why we oppose that industrial inclusion.
So, Ms. Lothammer, what are the differences in the standards, you know, between industrial and municipal?
Mr. Chair, basically the standards, the water quality requirements are the same. What's different is that the tools that we have that allow us to consider things like affordability. For municipal permittees, it's a lot more straightforward because we can look at things like the median household income and also look at things like the debt service load that a municipality is undertaking in order to construct a wastewater treatment facility. That just gets, it's not the case that we can't look at those things for industrial permittees. It just gets more complicated. So that 16-year time frame becomes potentially more challenging in that environment. So that's the basis of our concern.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then moving on to Section 6, which is regarding permit fees. Again, this language, I think Mr. Quillis noted, is similar to language in a separate bill that's moving through the legislature. The agency does oppose the language regarding permit fees for two key reasons. First of all, the commissioner believes that the legislature does have sufficient oversight of the agency already. There are many paths currently in existence for legislative oversight, including committee hearings, appropriations, reporting requirements, audits by the legislative auditor, and also direct communication. And then secondly, our water program fees have not been comprehensively addressed since 1992. There has been legislative discussion, but it kind of over those years, but it's never been comprehensively resolved or addressed. During that same time, we've seen new requirements placed on the agency around water, and also our general fund as a percentage of our overall funding for water efforts has steadily declined, and we've actually received no inflationary increases of our water fees since 1992. So all of this has actually led the commissioner to reaching out this past summer to stakeholders with preliminary questions about water fees. We received a lot of comments and a lot of interest in this, and as a result, in response to those comments, the commissioner directed our staff to set up an advisory committee, which is the Water Fee Advisory Committee under Chapter 14.101, to advise him on how best to address the structural imbalance and the concerns with our water fees. That group has been meeting regularly monthly since about January. They do have a couple of more meetings scheduled, and the commissioner will then be considering those recommendations as he decides to proceed. So just another example of how we are taking strides to really get input on those permit fees and consider those, but we are concerned about the language and in opposition of the language in Section 6. And again, with that, then I conclude my comments and be happy to have or respond to any additional questions.
Thank you. I'd like to go to Ms. Becker Kadelka, come down and testify. We'll get back to Representative Lagunias and Hansen. I do want to, while you're stepping away, Ms. Lothammer, I do want to go back to in 15 when the issue of water fees came to the legislature. MPCA said we don't have the statutory authority, and now you're saying that you do. So we're trying to clarify some things. Well, I'm sure that discussion will continue. Good morning. Welcome. Identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Angie Becker Kadelka, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Proceed, please.
Mr. Chair and members, the DE2 addresses the concerns of the agency, including sections 103B and 103G. Namely, now that the bill reads in a way that supports the wetland banking process to keep the program functioning so that public and private wetland users have access to this program. Furthermore, as Section 2 provides direction to the agency on agency costs, our Bowser Board Wetland Committee met on March 19th and is recommending a methodology for how to base costs to the agency, and that is moving forward to our full board this week. So the DE2 addresses agency concerns. Thank you.
That's good. Okay. Well, we could go into wetland banking issues here, too, but we'll talk offline. Question. We're going back to Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think it's important for Minnesotans to pay attention of how regulatory capture occurs. Bill by bill, act by act. Following up on Representative Uglum, so I would be more likely to support this if it actually had independent peer review, if the universities had publicly funded science that could be used to evaluate. But often the sound science that was alluded to earlier is the science that people agree with or the science that interests pay for. And so integrating that, and I understand the agencies for this. I understand the pressure they're under. But it seems in bill after bill, we integrate in steps towards regulatory capture where the outcome, yes, Representative Torkelson, it is doom and gloom. Look at the state of our waters. Hundreds of millions of dollars of public money spent It's always the public that has to pay the cleanup costs. And so we take action and act as if it has no consequence, that putting in these processes has no effect except to make people happy, that, well, let me not say people, interests happy, that they're involved and that they can continually be camped out at the agencies working on challenging every time there is a proposal made to protect the public waters, protect the public health. There's always a cost likely to commerce, and commerce doesn't like that. We used to fund significantly our public universities. But now our public universities also have to go to the private interests to get funding as well. So external peer review can mean one thing or it can mean another. And the practical impact is that the people with resources are going to be the people that can provide the external peer review. And the people with resources may not have the public interest. They may have the private interest involved. And there isn't the balance in terms of making sure what's perfect or what's right or what's sound for Minnesota or the country. I am not confident with the federal government being the backstop on water quality protection, with the wreckage that's going to be done with it by the Trump administration to the Environmental Protection Agency.
Okay. Representative Morginius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your wise remarks, Representative Hansen. From Ms. Lockhammer's testimony, she said that with regard to wastewater treatment systems and the difference between municipals and industrials, there was a question of cost to municipalities. And I think you find consensus around this table that we're all concerned about the cost to municipalities, and also certainly I can only speak for myself, a willingness to pay and to set aside money up front to help wastewater treatment systems that may need to be upgraded because of new regulation. That's fine. But what I did not hear Ms. Lockhammer say, and I'm sure she'll correct me if I am wrong, but what I did not hear her say is that she knew what additional pollutants would go unregulated, which additional pollutants would get into our drinking water because we, a million Minnesotans, drink Mississippi River water. And there are 203 wastewater treatment systems north of the intakes. So we don't know. So I am, just as I am worried about the same things that Representative Hansen is worried about, it does seem to me that practically speaking, we could come to a consensus around this table on what to do about the wastewater treatment systems, because it's all about the money. So I would hope, since this is your bill, Mr. Chair, that you would solve that problem before this bill gets to the floor.
Thank you. I would, you know, just a couple of quick comments because it's directed towards me. You know, the idea that this is just about business and industrial, nothing could be further from the truth. I've had many, many, many cities, mayors, council people come to me over the last 2 to 4 years talking about peer review and using good science and talking about cost benefit, you know, spending $52 million in one city to reduce what's going out by a very, very small fraction. Does it really get to the root of the problems? We all care about water. We all care about costs. We care about good science. And this is just another step along that path to try to get to a better place from my perspective. And I respect the opinions of people at this table and in this building and across the state of Minnesota. But I have lots and lots and lots of people come and talk to me about what's going on with regards to how we get to a water quality standard and how much is it going to cost and how much benefit are we going to get out of it. And we have to face the reality, as my good friend, former Representative Ruka Vila used to say, there's not enough money in the state to do some of the things that some people want to do. So with that, we'll go to Representative Clark Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm trying to discern the testimony from both Bowser and from the MPCA with related to the fees and the sure. cost of their work. And what struck me was that Bowser was able to work with the people they work with, and in this bill, they're satisfied, if I heard this correctly, with the fee structure. I also heard that MPCA has not heard had their fees addressed since 1992. I've sat on this committee for a number of years, and it's pretty clear that they've been challenged financially. I also heard that they're working with a group. I maybe want to know more about that group to come to a resolution of this. I think the reality is it's pretty clear that they're short on funding. And so my question is really for you, Representative Fabian, and that is, have you looked at a way to kind of take more of the Bowser route and the MPCA route and find work with them to find a way so that they can be funded, so that they can do the work? You know, Minnesotans want clean water. There's no doubt about that, and the MPCA is directly involved with that. My fear, whenever we get into legislative oversight, we've seen political spats. Again, that's been my experience over 6 years and on multiple angles. And once we get there, there's the risk of the MPCA not being able to look forward to the sort of funding they need to do their work. So, again, my question for you, have you looked at a way to manage this differently in this bill so that the MPCA would also have the funding that they need to do the public's work?
Well, a question for you, Representative Johnson, and I'll get to your question, too, is how long has this perceived shortage of funding been in existence at MPCA?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hate answering your question, but I'll do it because all I know is for 6 years. This is my sixth year here, and I've heard this for 6 years, and particularly in the last 4 years.
And I recognize that we're oftentimes in a political place, but in 2013, Chair Wagenius was in charge of this committee, and I think that potential was there. What I've asked for from MPCA is justification for raising their fees, and quite frankly, I haven't seen that, and if other members have, that would be news to me. We're looking for sound financial management over at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I think that we've tried to work with them on a variety of issues, and if they want to come into my office and talk about these things, or if we want to stand in the hallway so that people can listen to our conversations, I'm fine with that too. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Fabian. I would just say that I would encourage you to see if you can find to reconcile that. And also in a larger issue, what I'm feeling with this bill is that there's a number of provisions in here that there's agreement for. We heard that from the agencies. And it seems to me, I assume you get the emails I get from constituents who are saying, let's deal with one bill at a time, one bill at a time, one concept at a time. This might be an example where they're cobbling together a number of controversial issues with some solid publicly supported issues creates a problem for the bill. Have you considered splitting this bill up so in those areas where there can be agreement? I think we showed on the floor yesterday we can act pretty fast on the House floor where there's agreement, and I have you considered that?
Not to this point, I have not, no. Representative Karen Clark. Yep. And then we got another person to testify. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if Mrs. Lockhammer should come back up. The question was...
Who did you want?
Mrs. Lockhammer.
Okay. Commissioner Lockhammer, please.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering, when you said that one of the important distinctions with the federal standards versus what's being proposed here... is that the federal EPA standards, does the tool they use allows for looking at the household income and tax base, and this would not. Is that, did I understand that correctly?
Ms. Lothammer.
Mr. Chair and representatives, so what I was speaking to is that when we're evaluating how quickly a facility needs to come into compliance with new standards, the federal term is as soon as possible. And under EPA guidance, one of the things that we can consider when we're looking at things like as soon as possible is, you know, how long does it take to get financing in place, and how long does it take to develop plans and specs for a capital improvement, things like that. And when you're addressing a municipal publicly owned facility, one of those financing questions is looking at things like the debt load to the community and the affordability or the impact of that debt load. So that's what I was referring to when I was speaking to this part of the bill.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, if I remember some of the earlier discussions, I don't know, a month or so ago about this bill, one of the reasons for this bill was so that the local folks could afford to deal with the cost of an upgrade, right? And I think that was in the first one. I'm sure you would care about that. So it seems to me like we might want to revisit putting something like that back into this bill if it's out, which I think it is, because I think we're talking about what the cost is to the local community. That was a big thing. And then one of the things about the other questions I have, I guess, is what's special about 16 years? Why is that enough time maybe for a local community? I mean, is there a reason for that number that I've forgotten?
And I'm going to deflect to Representative Lewick. That's his bill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Quickly, please.
And two reasons. One, there's a funding element there that has to do with 20-year bonds. There's also a engineering process there that has to do with designing a system to function without major overhaul or replacement for approximately 20 years. So you've got two elements there. It's like you buy a new car, you usually get $100,000 warranty, 100,000-mile warranty with it. Well, that's we try to build things with that same manner, only we attach a year or hours of operation to it. So you got two elements there. One, that debt service and what it costs, how long does it take those people in the community to pay for that before you got to change it again. And the other is we like not to build things and then immediately have to replace them. We like to get the useful life out of them.
Right. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just to follow up on that. So it seems to me this does come back to the question of paying attention to what the community can afford, which I know you're attuned to, and I presume this is also, but I think some of the discussion that's happened here about, you know, helping communities ahead of time, having enough money in the fund so that we're dealing with those folks, it seems to me then we don't have like a whole generation waiting for clean water. And I guess I would just ask, you know, as you go forward with this bill to kind of look at that, because it seems to me that's really important. If some of what is going on is we're not willing to invest enough money up front, so a small community would be burdened for 20 years, we ought to change that. We ought to look at a different way to understand how we clean up the water.
Yeah, well, and there's some members of that think that small communities are just going to go away completely, which I don't want to have happen, so I'm trying to look out for them. Mr. Tenreich, would you proceed, please?
No, I'm going to go away there.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mark Tenreich with MCEA, the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. MCEA was founded in 1974 to protect and preserve the state's environment and the health of its people. We appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and we appreciate the improvements in the DE amendment, particularly the provision on watershed credit exchange, often discussed as trading. While our organization has a fairly long history of being involved in trading and believes it has great promise for the future, it needs a little more discussion, I think, and there are other bills moving, and I think something will come of this, but we're happy to see it removed from this bill. having said that, we do oppose 3120 for several reasons, many of which have been discussed, so I won't go into them in detail. First, in Section 3, that overturns the Court of Appeals case by allowing waters to be transmitted from one water body to another without a permit. Allowing water transfers without a permit is poor policy. Not all waters of the state are the same. In some cases, the water chemistry of the two waters is so different that the water itself is a pollutant. So we've heard a little bit about the different kinds of transfers here today, some by DNR, some transcending watershed boundaries. We just think this needs a little more thought before we provide a blanket exemption. Possibly something needs to be done for new discharges, maybe existing connections, existing transfers, but we need to think maybe a little bit more about new transfers. In Section 5, and there's been a fair amount of discussion about this just recently with reference to Representative Lueck's bill, which was heard earlier this session. This does expand it to industrial dischargers, and we've discussed that at some length here. MCA has concerns and would and does oppose this section of the bill. Finally, on the PCA fees, much of what we've much of what I had in testimony here has been discussed, but I would point out one thing, that there is a fairly significant backlog of permitting at the PCA. PCA needs resources to catch up on that permitting and to do an efficient job going forward. So this sort of bottleneck on the PCA fees is really an anti-streamlining measure. So if you view the chamber bills over the years as streamlining bills, this is one piece that doesn't quite fit in that niche. So thank you. Stand for any questions.
Thank you. Representative Clark Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, you know, I'd like to refer to the part about on 3.233 through 3.26. If I recall testimony this morning, it was referred to really, this is a DNR issue. We have not heard about the DNR, from the DNR on this. I would invite them to give us their testimony. We've heard from MPCA, but I believe MPCA acknowledged that this was more of a DNR permitting issue.
Assistant Commissioner? Hop on down here on that gimpy knee.
Cast that injury.
That's good.
Mr. Chairman,
thank
members,
you.
For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Representative Johnson, could you repeat your question for me?
Yeah,
Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm referring to Section 5, the new language in Section 5. And if I recall correct, the testimony earlier was that from the PCA was that these are really DNR permits. The transfer of water. And
I think you're actually referring to Section 3, Subdivision 5.
I'm sorry.
Is that correct? Give us the lines, please, Clark.
I'm looking at line 3.233 through 3.26.
Yep. Ms. Lodhammer, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair and representatives, just to maybe clarify the comments that I provided earlier. So this provision is basically, we're talking about two different kinds of permits. So the DNR already permits a lot of the water transfer kinds of activities are covered by DNR permits. What this would do is exempt from also requiring a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit from the PCA. So go with just one permit rather than requiring that both the DNR and the PCA permit these activities. Now, there are maybe a few types of activities that aren't covered by DNR permits, but the agency does have other tools that we can use if there's a concern about water quality that wouldn't require an NPDES permit.
Which goes to Mr. Tenreich's comments about what he was concerned about. I think that those are not well-founded because we have two different agencies here that do regulate the movement of water between two bodies. So, Representative Johnson.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks for the clarification. That my follow-up, though, is I'm also concerned. Representative Hansen raised issues about transfer of water across the Continental Divide. That's significant. That's very significant in my mind. Do either of the agencies have concerns about that? And how are how is that situation currently addressed if there's multiple, perhaps by the DNR? How is that protected now?
To the testifiers.
Well, Mr. Chair and representatives, so again, if there's a public waters work permit that's required from the DNR, there are provisions in there, and I'm not expert, of course, on their rules, but making sure that there isn't created a water quality or a natural resources issue because of that transfer. And then under the in any case, the water quality standards are always applicable, and under the Pollution Control Agency's legislation and statutes, there are tools that the agency can use if there is a violation of water quality standards or an imminent threat to water quality standards that wouldn't require an MPDES permit, or we could step in a particular situation by situation, and issue a permit. So I think the reason why the agency is supportive of this language is because there are other mechanisms in place to address the concern about water quality.
Representative Johnson.
And then, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be clear, the issue of invasive species, would you repeat with that? Are you also satisfied in that realm?
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Yep. Representative. Yeah, as Commissioner Lautheimer was talking about, there are other rules and statutes in place right now. Currently in rule, we're prohibited from issuing permits that will cause water pollution, which would include impairment or destruction of the air, water, or land, or other natural resources. So that would cover that invasive species concern. And obviously it's going to be a case-by-case basis depending on the pollutants and the situation, but we're doing everything we can to make sure that if there are water transfers, that they're done, that it's needed and it's done the right way.
Thank you. Anything else? Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is there a fiscal note requested on the after the DE amendment?
I believe there is, yes.
Okay.
Could we... I can't remember.
Well, I guess I'd ask for one.
Sure. Okay.
And then on the question of, and I know we've got to go quick, I would ask for a roll call.
Sure.
I have a second question of, do you have any indication of targets? Are you going to be getting any targets? I know that Representative Metza has a bill for research for NRI that would be additional money. Do you, any insight as to targets for this committee?
The spotlight is still shining out there someplace. I do not have a target, no.
Okay. Thank you.
Members, anything else? Representative Hornstein.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I'm bothered by this addition of the industrial dischargers, and sort of to Representative Wagenius's questions earlier, I don't know if it's Ms. Lockhammer or Mr. Quillis, but I'd like some examples of who are some of these industrial dischargers? What would be examples of them? I know, we have the Monticello plant, for example, north of us, that discharges water. So what are some examples of the that we're looking
at? Mr. Close, maybe Ms. Lockhammer, too, I'm not sure. We need to get wrapped up here. I know we got other things going on. There's another committee coming.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, it would be anybody that has a wastewater treatment plant, so any manufacturing facility, any agricultural facility, any agricultural processing facility.
Do you have some specific ones, though?
Not off the top of my head, but I'm going to also inquire the agency because of Representative Wagenius' questions of the number and distances from...
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. All right. With that, just making sure. Okay, good. With that, roll call hadn't been requested. I will renew my motion. I want to make sure I have my motion correct. To re-refer House File 3120 to the General Register as amended. So the chair votes aye.
Heinzman.
Aye.
Hansen.
No.
Backer.
Aye.
Becker Finn.
No.
Bliss.
Yes.
Clark.
No.
Eklund.
Aye.
Fisher.
Pass.
Green.
Aye.
Hoppe.
Aye.
Hornstein.
No.
Johnson. Bryan.
Aye.
Johnson.
Clark. No.
Lehman.
Yes.
Lewick.
Aye.
Metza.
Aye.
Neuberger.
Aye.
Poston.
Aye.
Sundin.
No.
Swedzinski.
Aye.
Torkelson.
Aye.
Uglum.
Yep.
Wagenius.
No.
There being 16 ayes and 7 nays, the bill is passed. Representative Netza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just did want to comment that earlier this year, in fact, we did hear a bill that gave would give funding to the DNR and MPCA to work together on standards. We funded it in 13-14, and I appreciate that hearing, but just the gentleman who testified earlier, we have been working bipartisanly on those issues in regard to making sure they have some staff. I think we could be doing more, and hopefully when we get our targets, we'll be able to do something, but just want to put that on the record.
Good point. Thank you. With that, we're adjourned, members.
Good job.